We'll just spend the 2 weeks then reviewing almost everything, because what I just want to do for you is to put together what's happened over the last couple generations in theology and show you a little bit of how each of the movements thinks. Excuse me. I'm rather inclined to Professor Van Til's perspective that all thinking is circular. And if you begin to understand the presuppositions from which a man works, then you pretty much know what he's going to do wherever he goes. I think that if you would answer somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 8 theological questions for me with some detail, I could pretty much tell you what you would have to conclude on most of the other questions of theology. And, you know, thinking is interrelated. It's interwoven, or else it's irrational. And some of the people we're going to look at is irrational, but if they're irrational in one area, you know, it's going to carry over into other areas, and there is even a consistency to the irrationalism. And therefore, I am not going to try to spend a lot of time in details. I'm not going to spend a lot of time developing a lot of men. But I'm going to try to give you an overall perspective, and I'm going to try to split it in half. Most of you all have before you a chart, don't you, a survey of contemporary Protestant theology. I decided to not make you take notes on this, and I may chart it out for you a little bit along the way, so you'll know where we're talking. But essentially, I want to spend 1 week on one side of the chart, and a week on the other side of the chart. I'm going to assume that most of you are not seminary trained, and therefore, you know, you would like to see a little bit of why we have the various groups we do in each side of the chart. Now, because some of you have been through this before, I'm going to put in a segment or two that we have not done before, and that is that I'm going to move outside of the realm of Protestant theology and move to Roman Catholic theology as well, because I'm rather persuaded that what's happening in Roman Catholic theology is significant to our day. First of all, because it's really nothing different than what's happened to Protestant theology. The only difference is it took 4 centuries for it to happen to Protestant theology. And it's happened to Roman Catholic theology, at least publicly, in about 2 decades. So that, you know, all you've done is capsulize the movements of theology and bring them into the heart of things. The second thing, reason why I want to do this a little bit, is that I think that Roman Catholicism is one of the largest segments of our society, but one of the most open ones to evangelism today, too. Because essentially they think like Christians. You know, they believe in God, they believe in the supernatural, they believe in Jesus Christ, they believe in a lot of things, but suddenly they have lost their moorings because they aren't sure their church does anymore. And so I think I'll take a session or two and we'll talk a little bit about what's happening in Romanism. And maybe that will fill our 2 weeks. Now, I want to start just talking about theology for a little while first, because for me, I think, when I think most basically, that there is only one theology and all else isn't theology. Now, if you do not have the true God and if you do not have the true revelation, how can you be thinking thoughts about God? But we're going to use theology in these 2 weeks in a far broader use than the way I would prefer to use it and the way I prefer to think it. Because I want to use theology in its most basic meaning, and that's theos, God, logos, word or thought or rationality. Words or thoughts about God. Now, in this most simple sense, every man is a theologian. They do not recognize it. They do not think it that way. But I'm convinced that God so moves in the process of time that every man comes face to face with himself and with God. But not only that, but I'm also convinced that God has so designed this world so that a man either has to blot it out or to come to some kind of definitions. And as soon as he makes those most basic definitions about life, he's starting to do theology. We often get that kind of statement, well, don't teach me theology, just teach me simple Bible. I went into a church when I was about 2 years out of seminary to preach, and it was considered one of the better churches in the Philadelphia area. And I went into the elders' meeting before the service, and I guess they panicked at the sight of what they had for the day. But one of the elders took me aside and said, well, now, Dr. Hook, we don't want any big theological discourse. We just want a simple gospel message. Well, I was a little bit upset, first of all, because he thought he needed to say that to me, and secondly, because he thought that's really what he wanted. Because it's really not terribly demanding if you can be 20 years old in the Lord and still just listen to simple gospel messages. You can go through life pretty comfortable because all of that's behind. But you see, suddenly he's starting to say some things very subtly, and that is, don't upset the way I think and don't challenge us. Just tickle the ears of the unbelievers that we've got here, if there are any, and don't bother the pew. But you see, they've got a theology. They're thinking, and part of it is expressed in that very statement. But more often, it comes in the pitch of, well, why go to seminary? All he learned there is how not to do evangelism anymore, or all the things, but still, you're a theologian. And if I brought up a question like, let me take one that would probably set you off a little while, the sovereignty of God versus the will of man. Now, every one of you has some way that you have come comfortable to that. It may or may not be biblical. But every one of you has in some way or another worked out a way so that you can absolve God from responsibility for evil and yet still maintain God's right to be sovereign enough to answer prayer. Even at that most simple level of the thing, you've done it. And therefore, you have worked on the nature of God and the rationality of that process, worked through the thoughts, so that you can understand. But along with this, I'd like to just take you one step farther and have you look at the Pauline model. Because Paul's epistles are almost always three chapters of theory, theological statement, and then three chapters of practice, to use Ephesians as a model. Or Galatians works in the same model. Or Romans has 8 or 11 chapters, depending how you classify those 3, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And then the outworking. But the Pauline model is that thinking is the foundation to doing, to acting. And of course, this isn't strange of a scripture. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. And Paul works to change the process of the way men think as a foundation for changing the way they live. Right thinking produces right living. And of course, James, in dealing with the process of temptation, says, that temptation starts when we are led away of our own lusts and enticed in our mind. And then it starts to bear fruit in our lives. Rollo May said in one of his books that no man does anything on the spur of the moment. He has always thought about it before. And his conduct matches the way he thought. If you haven't thought about it, you freeze. And that sort of scares you when you start thinking about some of the ways we allow ourselves to think. You know, the daydreams that suddenly, given the right situation, become what we call the spur-of-the-moment conduct. But it's not spur-of-the-moment, according to the psychologist. The pattern has already been placed there in the way you think. So you see, what I want to start with you is a definition of God and theology that is broad enough so that wherever you turn, you're dealing with theology. Whenever man starts really thinking about some good questions. So, with this basic definition, that theology is thoughts or discourses or attempts to make rational the understanding of God, I'd like to spend a little bit of time broadening the use of the word God. We've worked with the word theology a little bit. Now I want to work with the word God a little bit. Because again, I have a very strict definition of God, that He is the infinite, eternal person, infinite in all His attributes and so on down through the normal kind of definition that we use in Christian theology, then there is only one God and all other gods not only are false gods, they are not gods at all. Now, Paul deals with meat offered to idols in this sense in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. How can meat offered to idols be anything? There is only one God. But then he moves on to talk about the man who really thinks that it is something. And you see, he has a false God that is not a real God, but in his mind, it is a real God. And therefore, the meat offered to that idol is different from other meat. Not because the God is real, but the God about whom he is thinking, he thinks is real. You see, in this sense, God becomes the ultimate reality, for example, in the life of a person. What do you really think is the definition of what is, how it is? Dr. Francis Schaeffer has a fascinating theory that I think has a great validity to it, in fact, an obvious validity, and that is that the scientific worldview could only grow up in a Christian culture. You see, if you move to an Oriental culture where the ideal is what's happening in nature, and one must blot out what he is through meditation or yoga or through some other kinds of things and tune into the universe, then it is impossible that man manipulate the universe to accomplish his purpose. Because the very definition of reality is such that man must tune into the universe, and therefore no science. But you see, the Christian view of reality is that reality is with God, and that creation exists by His action. And man is particular in creation because he is like God. And he is to use and subdue the creation in accomplishing his ends. And therefore, out of that kind of understanding, then there is no problem to manipulate creation to accomplish some purpose that you want to do. You see, it's Francis Schaeffer's theory that the reason the Western world is the scientific world, and the reason that we are the ones that have made the scientific advance, is because our culture is conducive to this. I would love to pursue this for a while because it has tremendous implications to what's happening in cultures today where technology comes in from the outside. And you see, it doesn't fit with the world. And you can think what happens to an Oriental culture where the science comes in from somewhere else and the theory doesn't match it at all. And then you can see what's happening to our culture where we have moved from the theory that allowed the science to come in. And we've moved now to where we are the cause of the process, the effect of the process, evolution. And we're in that terrible dilemma of being an effect and yet having the responsibility of being the cause for the next step. I read an evolutionist recently who said, if you don't believe in evolution until now, you jolly well better, because it is the only hope. Which he's got himself in a strange dilemma, because he says that the environment and the setting has caused us the way we are. But now we must turn around and change it so that what it causes next is different. But you see, we've lost the moorings where science is a properly understood thing. And now our society's out of joint. And we have made science a god, and it's been shown to be a false god. And now in the next 10, 20 years, we're going to have to rework totally our understanding of this process, or there's no way we can mesh it. So you see, in some sense or another, God is your definition of ultimate reality. And what you really see as the way things fit together is what you're going to have to put the name God on. Now, it may not be the God of the heavens, but that's when you are talking about God. There's another way that I'd like you to think about the definition of God. And this is in the concept of life goal. Now, I think that every man who lives has to have some reason to justify his existence. In fact, this makes witnessing a fascinating thing in this day, because there are so many people who've lost any reason to live, who cannot give you one good reason why they shouldn't commit suicide. You see, they've lost any satisfactory, sufficient goal by which to define life or to live life. But what does motivate us to action? What does become a worthwhile goal to get up in the morning and to do something? Most of the time, we're too much creatures of habit or of hunger to really spend a lot of time thinking about it. But if you are a little more like I am, and probably about 50% of you are, although maybe not in the navigators where getting up early is a virtue. Those moments between waking up and getting out of bed, if you really ask, give me one good reason why I ought to get up, it can be a very hard thing. Is work a sufficient reason? It's pretty hard to justify work being as a sufficient reason to get up, because all it does is just, you can expand this at length, and I don't want to. But see, something in the world is goal enough to make us do the most basic things of life. And then also has to, in some way or another, be called God. Now, for many, many people, in our materialistic culture, money becomes that God. It is the totally defining thing. I don't know whether any of you have ever taken the tests they give to prospective insurance salesmen or not. But I have a friend who took the test, flunked it flat. And then somebody said, well, why don't you take it again, but let me give you a clue. The insurance companies aren't interested in anybody that doesn't want to make at least $40,000 a year. So he went back and took the test again with that basic understanding that I am motivated to make $40,000 a year. Cool. Passed it with flying colors. Well, if you're going to try to sell somebody something they really do not think they need, particularly in the proportions you're going to sell it to them. Now, if you're going to do estate planning and prepare them for three generations of absolute financial security, it's pretty hard to rationalize that on I'm just doing them a good favor. In fact, I had an insurance salesman come to me after I was teaching prophecy a couple of years ago. He said, Phil, if what you're selling is right, what I'm selling is wrong. And, you know, it's a rather salesman's perspective of the process. But, you know, what is that thing that motivates life? For many, it's money. For many people, and many more than the money, it's just some need to be somebody, some kind of recognition, some kind of place in the sun. The more you counsel, and I'm sure as you work in discipling, the more you pick this up. If people are desperately motivated by just the need to be somebody, to have somebody to care, to have somebody love them. You see, their God becomes a very internalized self-recognition, self-expression. And then there becomes a more basic one in our society today, and that's that question, who am I? The goal of self-discovery, that I am an end. And yet that sufficient reason to live is to find out who I am. And of course, the Lord's dealt with some of these things so beautifully. Whosoever shall save his life shall lose it. And you can embark on that era of self-discovery. But it's liable to be a very discouraging process. Because the more you find, usually the less you like. I set out to discover who I am, and now I wish I didn't know, you know? Because you discover the depravity, you discover all of the things there. I got a call from a fellow this last week, a man. The man said, you know, I did something that I cannot believe that I did. And I said, well, is it something that other people do? Oh, yes, it's other people do things like that. But I can't believe that I did it. You see, even a lot of Christians have not come very much to grips with the fact that we really are sinful. And that if we really do discover what we really are, we're going to like it. But most of the time, we don't accept it. You know, we rationalize away and say, well, I wouldn't have done that normally. Or that's really not me. But see, to some degree or another, you have to write God over that most basic motivating thing in life. There's another area that you have to write God over, I think, and that's the preoccupying thoughts of life. One of the things that I find interesting to do in counseling is to ask a person, what have they thought about? And if you have an hour free, what goes through your mind? You ended up driving yesterday for about 12 solid hours. It doesn't take a whole lot of intelligence to drive. In fact, sometimes I have a little time left over to think, you know. And it becomes a fascinating thing when the 12-hour drive is done to go back and see, all right, what did you do with those 12 hours? Because I was talking to a new Christian Thursday or Friday this last week. And he said, you know, Phil, I have to consciously jar myself every once in a while to remind myself that God's with me. To remind myself that I'm to be trusting in Him. Now, that's a tremendously encouraging kind of response to get from a person. But a lot of us have been Christians a long time, and how much does it affect our thinking? But when you move away from Christianity, you know, what does preoccupy? And you come awfully close to one of the things that that person calls God. Now, not all people are monotheistic. In fact, most people are polytheistic. They have several gods. And they may have a god that falls in every one of these categories. A god whose definition of ultimate reality of most Americans that I've talked to is that, well, he's sort of a nice guy like me, and if I do the best I can, he won't get too upset with me. And you see, their ultimate reality then is, well, it's okay as long as you're really doing okay, sincere about it. Don't ask them what sincerity means. But then along with this, they'll have a motivating goal that probably for most Americans today is just not to be troubled. A minimum of pain, a minimum of anxiety, minimum of frustration. Just don't trouble me. Give me enough money so I don't have to worry about money, enough security so I don't need to worry about security, enough religion so I don't need to worry about religion, enough pills so I don't need to worry about pain, and enough comfort so I don't need to worry about my troubles. And they'll pretty much operate at the level of, you know, as long as there's nothing wrong, then I'm, you know, that's sufficient. And then their preoccupying thought will almost be, how can I one-up the person that I'm talking to? And whether they're telling stories about who drove the fastest yesterday or the longest or saw the worst accident or, but you know, some way or another to get some ego satisfaction in the pecking orders of conversations. And, but now I've tried to keep you awake for a little while. But I've also tried to get you thinking about what are you really talking about when we're talking about theology and contemporary theology. And strangely enough, whether you go all the way from evangelicalism to the other end of it, whether it be process theology or the God is dead theology or linguistic analysis or some of those things, people pretty much have lots of theory and not a whole lot of practice. You know, within the church, probably the most discouraging thing is to hear all the beautiful things they believe and then to have to measure their lives day by day. But it's also interesting that the people who believe in linguistic analysis, you know, that in analyzing language, we really can't even be sure we ever communicate. And that words are sufficient to communicate from here to there, that they sit down and write books about it. And expect you out of their books to understand what they're saying can't be done. And the beauty of the inconsistency of life is a pattern that goes everywhere where we are. And yet, if I can sneak in a couple personal words, I am convinced that God's revelation is a foundation of understanding all that is and a foundation for fitting together what is and what we do in a way that life can be holistic, that it can be without inconsistency and without contradiction. And then the beautiful thing about it is that God's provided forgiveness for the problems. You know, so often we provide rationalism or rationalizing or rationality. There's no way that we can perfectly mesh it. And God's answer is, I forgive you and I accept you and I love you. And you see, then life moves beyond just a perfect consistency, but moves on to the real nature of what relationships are. And the knowing and sharing and
and building together.
Now, are you with me this far? Comments, questions, you want to react? Oh, let's do that another time. Otherwise, we'll lose contemporary theology in the process. I'd have to make them up right now. Otherwise, you with me? All right. Let me talk just a little bit further about sources of theology, and then a little bit about what theology is like at a step beyond, and then I want to move to the chart. Where does one's views of theology, of ultimate reality, of life goals, of preoccupying thoughts, of system organizing, rationality, where do they come from? I'd like to borrow from John Macquarie's book on theology, his list, and then I'd like to adapt it to my purposes a little bit. But he says, number one, experience. That theology grows, first of all, out of what happens. What happens to us. And probably this is the most basic level that theology is developed. Because for some reason or another, man always has to be able to explain. Always has to be able to explain what happened to him, the relationships around him. And as he seeks to explain, to put it together, he starts to develop his theology. Anthropologists say that almost every religion that's ever been studied has some kind of definition of God, who is an ultimate being outside of creation. It's only educated cultures that have moved away from that. But most cultures worship intermediary gods. Sun, moon, thunder, lightning, seasons, other things. Because it's at this level they experience their relationships. And so they develop a pattern of gods who are really negative gods. They're bad gods. You know, thunder and lightning are really bad gods. The sun... thunder and lightning, rain comes along with it, sun, light comes along with it, but also comes an awful lot of negative things, particularly in certain areas of the world. And so they worship gods that are more built out of fear and lack of ability to control than they are out of gods that are more real. This has come to be called the kind of God of the gaps. That what man has been unable to explain, he has sought to call God. And of course, the longer we live and the more we can control life, the less we need those kind of gods, and we think any kind of God. And so we abandon this. But this is the source of theology, the experience of the day-by-day process. The second of the sources is revelation. And that is some kind of disclosure. Now, for Christianity, this is ultimately Jesus Christ, a person who is the ultimate revelation of what God is like, what true theology, theological thinking is like, through whose eyes we ought to be able to see all and understand, through whose life we ought to be able to express all and become all that should be. But somewhere, theology needs some way to explain that which it cannot explain, to know that which it cannot know. You see, this is the key of the process of revelation. It is the disclosure of that which is not known or explained within the mechanism. Bertrand Russell said, "I cannot believe in a God who created because I've never seen a God create." Well, it has another side of it too. I don't believe in a world that just happened because I've never seen a world just happen. You see, the evidence for the decision is outside the realm of our empirical study. Therefore, if we are going to know with any certainty, we've got to have a revelation from somebody who was there. We'll never go beyond the level of theory from working with the evidence that we have empirically. You're with me on the word empirical, aren't you? From touch, the senses, from the process of using the senses and the mind to understand it. And you see, we'll never move beyond the level of theory and varying theories unless there is somebody there who saw it. We will work with, I use the word broadly, the accident that happened with the Russian airliner yesterday in France. Now, they will very painstakingly take every part of that airplane, put it back together. They will analyze all of the data from the recording instruments and everything. But they still will never really move beyond some kind of theory of what really happened. Because even with something that we saw happen, we have all the pieces left over when it happened. The problem of cause and effect, to some degree or another, escapes our ability to really determine. And so theological thinking somewhere has to have some kind of revelation, some kind of word from outside itself, spoken with authority, that defines what it has to say. Now, Christianity is not the only religion with revelation. Almost every one of its cults has revelation. I was in a motel in Georgia last weekend, and a little bit bored and not a whole lot to do, but about a half hour to kill, so I opened the dresser drawer, and there was a Bible and a Book of Mormon. And I chose to read the Book of Mormon for that half hour. I ended up going to sleep rather than reading it very long. But it started out saying that, in the introduction to it, this is something that Joseph Smith got from God. And it came on plates written in some kind of Oriental religion, and he translated those plates, and this is the word from God for our century, for our generation, for all time now, because the church that Christ started died out. It failed at what it should have done, and so God, through Joseph Smith, brought further revelation and understanding so that we might have the true church, the church of the Latter-day Saints. You see, they are dealing with a revelation, a word that makes things fit, that makes them understandable. And you have this with almost every religion in the world. Sometimes the revelation is oral tradition, sometimes it's other, but some kind of word that explains with authority other words. A third thing that primarily is characteristic of Christian theology, but is characteristic, as we just noted, of the cults, is a revelation that moves beyond the person to the written, the inscripturated. And for Christian theology, it is the Scriptures that are that source book. Fourth, tradition. And tradition is the accumulated wisdom, understanding, practices, rituals, habits of the past that fit together the revelation, the experience. And tradition becomes a pretty powerful, not only protector of the religion, but perpetuator of it. It's amazing. I'll use some church illustrations this week because that won't get too close to a lot of you. It's amazing what happens. I can't resist a needle once in a while. It's amazing what happens when you want to change the order of service. I really mean, you're not pastors, so you're not involved in that. But, you know, just try to put the offering first, the sermon next, and then the hymns, which point back to what you just preached about and become an expression to God of the worship and praise of what God has spoken. Now, it sounds like a perfectly logical way to have a Sunday morning service, but try it. Well, the bulletin is inerrant as the Bible is. In many kinds of situations. You know, for 30 years we've done it this way. Or 30 generations. And the weight of the accumulated past comes flooding in and shapes the way theology is thought. I was talking to a young man one day who happened to be a Roman Catholic, and it's easier to use this kind of illustration. But he was very upset and concerned. I was sharing the gospel with him a little bit, and I asked him, why do you go to church? And he couldn't really come up with a good reason why. And his primary reason why church was no good was that people just went there to be seen. And so I said, well, why do you go? And he ended up saying, well, to see who went there to be seen. it's so easy to be caught in the process that nothing happens at church. We go to watch. And really to change it to involve something goes against what theology has developed ought to happen there. Another source is culture. My apprehension about facial hair was related to one of my cultural understandings of the navigators. You know, with the sideburns right at the middle of the ear and the military bearing through the whole process, you know, which was the navigators in the era when I was most affected by you and when I used the verses and was, to somewhat involved in the Bible study and so on. And see, that cultural shaping shaped my insecurity about relating to you. Because it's very easy that the cultural perception of Christianity or any other religion becomes part of its dogma, part of its theology. I don't know how many people in the era when I was a dean told me that Christian music was 17th or 18th century music. And if it went beyond Bach and that kind of person or the hymnology of the early part of the 20th century, it no longer could be Christian, particularly if it had a beat. But you see, music is a cultural expression, and strangely enough, when God chose to record the Psalms, He only recorded the words. He didn't give us an inspired melody and rhythm and speed, or whatever you call that. Music's not really my world, on how to sing the Psalms. He didn't say sing them slow, sing them fast. You see, the music is the cultural expression. The words are the revelational expression. But it's very easy for culture to become the defining aspect of what is theologically valid, what is really true, what is dogmatically so. And of course, we get ourselves into a pattern of reasoning that is primarily pragmatic. You know, if it works, it must be good. And then we fear a rock music concert that is Christian for fear somebody may get saved and it would prove that it was good. Or vice versa. See, we haven't wrestled at the very real level of understanding. And we are allowed to shape, or we allow ourselves to shape theology culturally. But culture does shape it. You know, there seems to be a Christian way of praying or of dressing. Or more than that, that because our culture, which is obviously the most successful one in the world by many measuring points of view and also founded on Christian principles, becomes the true expression of what Christianity really is. So that when we export Christianity, we export the culture of America along with it. And you know, this has been one of our major problems in missions. Is what is the real relationship of culture to theology? Because obviously you cannot move into a culture and adopt it. Paul didn't do this at Corinth or elsewhere. But neither did Paul take Judaism and export it. But you see, one of the very crucial parts of theological perspective is tied to the culture. Now, I want to take culture one more step, and that is in its words. Because language is probably the most specific expression of a culture. And the words you use, the kind of words a culture or a language has, are expressive of those things that it feels are important. And frankly, I feel that God so moved in the world so that the languages of the Old and the New Testament were perfectly designed to be a sufficient medium of revelation. You would have had a hard time saying some of the things that the Lord chose to say through the apostles and the prophets in some of the other languages. Now, that doesn't mean we should all start speaking Greek. But it means that the very way you say something and the very kind of question you ask is a cultural reflection upon your theology. You know, it's interesting to me that our cause and effect pattern of thinking, culture, our scientific culture, wrestles far more with the problem of the sovereignty of God and the will of man than other cultures do, where cause and effect is not so carefully defined. It's fascinating to watch Peter on that day when he's with the Lord. Who do men say that I am? Who do you say that I am? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Blessed art thou, Simon, son of John. Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. Now, if I were there, if I were Peter, I would say, Lord, I thought that up all by myself. I've been thinking on this for 2 years. And I finally come to a conclusion, and you say, God did it. And then a few minutes later, he says, I'm going to die. And Peter says, Lord, no, I'm not going to let that happen to you. I love you. You've become one of my great friends. I'm going to take care of you. And the Lord says, get behind me, Satan. Peter says, Lord, I thought that up all by myself. Satan didn't do that. I really do care about it. You see, but Peter didn't argue causation. But we would have. I would have. You see, that cultural expression of vocabulary, of question, of pattern of thinking becomes a source and the shape and the nature of what theology is. I look forward one of these days to spending enough time in a culture that is totally different from ours, in the hope that I can start to see better how my theology is culturally shaped rather than revelationally shaped. And what theology is going to mean in that culture. And I hope one of these days be able to take a year or two off and not go somewhere to teach, but go somewhere to just watch and learn. But you see, this becomes a primary source that shapes our theology. And finally, reason. Because for some reason or another, we are not only reasoning and rational creatures, we like everything to fit together neatly. And we want it to fit the way we perceive the world, the way we understand it, the way we reason it out. Now, reasoning doesn't always have to be good. You can use a scientific study. You could sit out in the parking lot, and if you didn't know anything about cars and people and so on, say, I'm going to scientifically study what makes cars work. And you would soon come to the conclusion that when somebody opens the left-hand front door and sits behind the wheel, that's what makes a car work. And you see, it's very reasonable. If every time a car drives off, somebody gets in that seat, and every time a car stands still, there's nobody in that seat, and if the car goes somebody when there isn't somewhere in that seat, has an accident. You see, it becomes a very reasonable understanding. But because of other things, experience, understanding, it doesn't fit. But, you see, we just need it to be reasonable. And this is often the level of kind of thinking that we do. But it shapes and affects our thinking, our theology, our perception of what really is there. Now, there are all kinds of theology. There is Christian theology. There is conservative Christian theology. There is liberal Christian theology. There is Hindu theology. There is theology of marriage, theology of this, that, theology of Paul. The word can be widely used, because it is such a basic word. The same thing is true with God. That is such a basic word. And both of these are so inseparable from what man is that we are always doing, in some form or another, theology. Now, I've got two or three goals for our 2 weeks together, and I sneak them in at this point because I want you to know what we're doing, and maybe you can see part of what I have been doing already. But one of my goals is content, is to communicate to you some things. And we'll work at doing this. We'll take some of the areas. But a second goal that I have is to get you to think. To think about thinking, because we all think. But to get you to be maybe a little bit more analytic than you have been. To step back and use your spare time differently than we often do. I'm convinced that doing theology is about 50% meditation, and the other 50% the usual kinds of things of exegesis and understanding and study and, you know, the things you put together and the mechanical part of the process. Somehow or another, I hope that we can think together. And never allow you to really be comfortable again. My second assignment to first year theology students is to read a novel. And I would have hoped that if I asked you all what two books have you read in the last 2 months, that at least one of them would be a novel. Because almost every novelist is a theologian. And he's preaching at you. But he does it so subtly that you buy it without, without understanding. Or you reject it without hearing. Artists are theologians. Athletes may even be theologians. Nice guys finish last. It's a theological statement. It's a statement about a perception of reality, of goal, of the nature of man, of understanding. And you see, I hope that we can have a lot of fun, just learning to think in a little bit different way. Maybe you've already learned it. I hope so. Then we can maybe just prod and stimulate that process. I have a third purpose, and that's to preach a little bit. If I can call preaching putting the needle in, to prod a little bit in this process. So that we not only can't be comfortable with the way we think, but neither can we be comfortable with the way we live. Because to me, the amazing thing is that almost every heresy is founded on some truth. And that truth is usually grown out of a failure of the real truth to do what it ought to do. You see, theology is hammered out in history. Not because of the beauty of the opportunity to do theology, but theology in history is hammered out against the problem of errors. Nobody ever tried to work out the Trinity until they tried to work out who's Jesus Christ. And the more they came to the conclusion Jesus Christ is God, the more they had to deal with how do we put it together. You see, interestingly enough, we're living, I think, today in a generation when we're finally starting to do ecclesiology again, the doctrine of the church. Because the church very quickly slipped into a pattern in the New Testament of being somewhat similar to the synagogue, but then became more and more a structure and a hierarchy. Until pretty soon the church became the city of God. Not because it was biblical, but because that's the way it just grew. And much of Reformation thinking went back to reevaluate salvation, but not the church. And we perpetuated much of that. And suddenly, in our culture, when the church has been one of the mainstays of it, our culture is deteriorating, falling apart. And now we're starting to ask, whither the church? And you see, I hope to not only stimulate you to think, but that somehow or another this process will also translate into living, to really working with the questions that surround us, and tying in to relating them to how we live. Now, are you with me? Questions, comments, Russ?
Most of these same things people tell me are the sources of philosophy. You carefully steered away from the word philosophy. How would you relate these two words? Are you just saying theology, by and large, isn't it synonymous with philosophy?
No, I'm not. You're asking a question that 20 centuries hadn't really solved. A very excellent question. And I want to tackle it in a very homemade way and see if I can help you understand it the way I understand it. The theological discipline works with material. When I talk about sources here, it works with experience, tradition, culture, reason. But it also works with revelation and with Scripture, particularly for Christianity. And for Christianity, theology is very carefully defined in its sources. Anytime I move beyond this book, I better be careful. I better put in an "it seems to me," or I better stop and see whether I even ought to be going that direction. You see, I've always got a checkpoint. Now, it is not written primarily theologically. We have probably three or four epistles in the New Testament that are written primarily theologically, and Romans, of course, is the epitome of that. But most of it is written historically, sermonically, in varying forms. But theology deals with making an understanding from the source, Christian theology. Now, I believe Christian philosophy is the checkpoint of the thinking process. It asks a different kind of question. It makes you stop and answer your questions a little bit differently. In metaphysics, what really is real? Now, in pure philosophy, I have to discover that by some system of philosophy. And of course, couple or three generations ago, a little more, philosophy gave up metaphysics because it cannot find out what is real. It decided it couldn't solve that, move beyond it. But see, it is a pattern of reasoning, asking questions, that does not start with authority, with source, but seeks in the pattern of thinking to understand, to work together. Now, when you move away from Christian theology, philosophy and theology are often very close together. But within Christianity, they are very distinct. The philosopher, according to Colossians 2, and I think there is a legitimate Christian philosophy, is a philosophy that is after Christ. It is under authority. But it can ask those same kind of questions that philosophers ask and deal with them. But at this point, it is the adjunct of theology. It makes sure theology has asked good questions and done good thinking. But it is never the end, and it is never the process. It is the auxiliary process. Now, when you move away from a revelation, then theology and philosophy become very closely entwined. And you see this probably most obviously in Bultmann, where he is very much committed to existentialism. And he uses this only as a source book for his illustrations, for his understanding of his philosophical system. Now, he comes up with a theology and a philosophy, but the relationship of the two is very different, because he's moved outside of an authoritative revelation in the process. Now, when I said in the beginning this is a question that hasn't been solved in 20 centuries, almost every theologian has some kind of solution to the process. Early in the church, the solution was that they are foreigners to each other. The philosophical is by nature bad. The theological is good. Then the period of the medieval church, of developing Romanism and the height of its Romanism, philosophy and reason and theology fit together. In fact, philosophy becomes the checkpoint of theology. Is it reasonable is more important than is it biblical? And then you have the separation again in the Reformation. And, these two have never been happy bedfellows across the board, because usually one or the other suffers in the long run. And as you can tell in my outline of it, philosophy suffers, because it is an auxiliary enterprise that is valid in testing other world systems and dealing with them, understanding them. It's valid in seeing whether theology has done a good job, but it never shapes theology and never becomes its source or its end. Is that satisfying? You mean Francis Schaeffer? No. I tried to put people in here that are clearly definable, and Schaeffer is harder to define than others. Now, a lot of people would debate a lot of the people that I have in here, and I didn't give you this to circulate. I give it to you as your private use, because almost nobody likes to be in a pigeonhole, and most of these people would object to the pigeonhole I put them in. And if you try to pigeonhole me, I'll probably object. But I just tried to use some sample people that are easy illustrations of a position. And I have not tried to pigeonhole everybody. I've talked with Francis Schaeffer about trying to pigeonhole him a little bit. And it's not easy to do, because he walks in two streets. One with his intellectual ministry, and the other with his very strong separatist ethic. And he's a little bit of an anomaly in this process, because he walks in a world that most of us do not, but he does it in a way that many of us do. And so he's an interesting combination.
I'm not sure I understood that last 2 minutes of discussion.
Good.
I want to...
Then I was as unclear to you as I am to me.
I want to just test that. Therefore,
go ahead.
And then therefore comes out, and maybe I've got it, I'm not sure. But you say, therefore, that the humanist and true liberalist would be more a philosopher than he would be a theologian. For he does not, he relies on reason as opposed to revelation from a being who is out there, who can be known.
Yeah, I think you're with me. But you see, theology and philosophy must always come to some kind of working definition. But I think as soon as you know, Mormonism isn't philosophical. In fact, it would fail very quickly, and if you tried to make it philosophical. Most of the cults are not, but they're revelational. On the other hand, most of liberal theology, most of what's on the right side of your page, which really should have been the left side of your page probably, but most of that is philosophically founded. There is a philosophical undergirding through which they see their theology. Now, I believe that theology and philosophy ought to be able to walk the street perfectly together. Because God is truth. There is no contradiction within Him, or within His revelation, or within His perception of the world, or within His thinking process. So that when we have begun to capture the mind of God, and have proper understanding of the reasoning process of man, they ought to fit. But it's always with revelation on top.
You would be keeping with your holistic concept. You said before, so you, your philosophy would be based on your theology.
Well, always has to deal with an authoritative source, which philosophy does not like to do.
And then philosophy is more of a process.
It is a way of thinking. You see, this is why philosophy of science has become one of the most crucial studies in the university today. Because the philosopher is moving into science today and asking the philosophical questions of a realm that has not tried to answer them, but has tried to make philosophical statements. You know, the biologist has said, my evidence in biology shows me that this is the way that you explain the whole world. Well, for a couple generations, he got away with it. He's not getting away with it anymore. And the philosopher is starting to say, well, now, is your method sufficient to say what you're saying? And, of course, the answer is starting to come back, no. That you cannot move from the scientific method to philosophical statement. There is not a direct correlation in that process. In fact, the scientific method may never be more than the theory by which we currently put together the way we use the world. You see, what's happened is the philosopher has gone into science and started to ask questions about how he thought. And the scientist is having some trouble. In fact, when the philosophy of science and some of the mathematicians and physicists at a conference about a year and a half ago got together and started saying, now there's no way that you biologists can really say what you're saying. The biologist really said, we didn't ask you to come. But you see, the philosopher, I think, has a very real role. But when it becomes an end, it's insufficient because it's got to have a revelation. Man is never going to solve what he is, starting from where he is. Of course, the failure of philosophy is that it thinks that it can when it is apart from Christianity.
Would you say then that the sources of philosophy are the same as the sources of theology that philosophy will be there?
No, the philosopher would deny most of the time that he is dealing with anything like revelation. Now, otherwise, yes, they do deal with experience, they do deal with culture, they do deal with reason. But, you know, the philosopher who has to deal with revelation is like the biologist who has to deal with Genesis 1. He's in trouble. Because his discipline and the nature of the way it goes is in contradiction, really, to the authority that he's talking to.
It seems to me that you treated these sources rather negatively, or at least by example of the tradition and so on. Are you saying that these are also positive, valuable sources of theology, valid theology?
No, I would think that revelation in the sense of Scripture is 98% plus of our sources for Christian theology, a true Christian theology. It needs to be understood and applied in our experience. It needs to affect our culture. It needs to fit in the way our minds work. But it never becomes subject to any of them. Yes. Most of the time these 2 weeks, I'm using theology in its most basic sense. I am not talking in the sense of what I think there is, and that is a true theology, that is the only theology, that is really the mind of God expressed in our world and time and universe.
You said that 2 or 3 generations ago the concept of metaphysics had pretty much passed away. And I was wondering 2 questions in that area. First of all, does theology offer a real solid answer in this area of philosophy? And secondly, is the concept of metaphysics coming back in philosophical?
The answer is yes to both questions. I think that theology, and here I'm using in the strict sense, Scripture, Christian theology, offers a definition of ultimate reality that is God, and therefore an understanding of all else that grows out of that, and therefore it has a true metaphysics. I have a friend at Wheaton, Art Holmes, some of you have read some of his literature, who was a very articulate and excellent philosopher. he wrote a book on metaphysics and couldn't get a publisher to publish it because they all said, you know, it's out. Nobody's doing metaphysics anymore. And then about a year ago, it got published. And so I think, you know, what is happening from what I can say, and this is a layman's perspective at the time. Philosophy is not my field. But what is happening is that I think philosophy is finding that you can't do much without some definition of what really is. You know, it's like trying to study softball watching the outfield.
Well, is that coming back from primarily from a theological point of view?
No, I think it's coming back from the point of view that every other street they've gone down has been a dead-end street. Really, when you get to the end of where philosophy's been today, you can't think, you can't touch, and you can't talk. And you're really tough if that's what your living is. You know, I realize I'm being extreme. And I think there is a danger in saturating oneself with the culture, you know, the stuff of this world. On the other hand, I think if we're going to communicate to this world, we're going to have to do it in some of the ways that it thinks and understands. To me, the puzzling thing is that we have little problem when we go to the mission field saying we ought to learn how the people think. We ought to learn how their culture expresses itself in order to adequately communicate the gospel to them. We have done a lot of good work, I think, in anthropology and cultural studies and sociology related to this fact that if you're going to translate the scriptures into the language of people, you have to understand it, its thought patterns, the way it works. If you're going to live with them socially, you have to know what's acceptable and unacceptable. And if you're really going to touch at the level of their needs, you're going to have to understand where they are. And I am a little bit puzzled why, when you come to the United States, that's not true. Because I find that sometimes the best part of getting ready to witness to somebody is listen to them for about 4 hours. And find out what they think and where they're hurting so that the ministry of Scripture can deal with where they are rather than my telling them what I think they ought to be thinking. Now, I recognize the danger. And I don't think that this kind of study is for everybody. I would not, if I were teaching prayer meeting for the next 12 weeks in church, do what I'm doing here. For the average man in the pew. Although I'd be tempted. But I would spend far more time with just biblical development and then good application of it to the world and understanding of it. But I perceive you as men who are not only working with believers, but seeking to reach unbelievers. If you understand what they're thinking, you understand how they think, it's awfully hard to communicate with them. And therefore, I think a little bit is where you are at the maturity level, what your ministry and responsibility is in regard to this. In addition to this, I think some of the finest illustrations of man's need for the gospel are founded in the literature that's being written. The films that are being shown. I went to a film this last week that when I walked out of it left me with an absolute feeling of despair. Now what had happened is that it had bypassed my mind and affected my emotions with the hopelessness of trying to love in a world beset with hypocrisy and disease and death and alienation. But in many ways, that film becomes the backdrop of Romans 1 to 3 in the presentation of the gospel to those people. because that's their depravity and its expression. And we've allowed the world to shake its fist at God and say, God, it's all your fault. If you were a loving God, the world wouldn't be this way. Rather than saying, hey, look at your own literature and look how your people destroy each other. And it doesn't take a God to do it. But the God of Scripture offers an answer and not a problem. He offers forgiveness and relationship for sin and alienation. I'm not sure he's talking more about theological disciplines than he was about understanding what's happening on the other side. And an awful lot of our theological discussions are empty chatter and foolish questions. I got a criticism this year from my teaching at the seminary, and one of the students said, I wish you'd quit saying that's a bad question. But sometimes I think we need to say that's a bad question. I think there are some questions that like a couple times I've said, you know, if God really wanted us to know that, he would have told us. And I think we ought to take the absence of his answer as some kind of implication for our question. And, I think that's what he's driving. I don't think he's driving at just the enemy. I think he's driving at the pointless, useless things. And I wouldn't promote reading books and doing things just to multiply evidence. On the other hand, I believe there is value in real understanding. My time's gone. I'm sorry we didn't get the chart. We'll start there first thing in the morning. Okay. Oh, yes. I would like you to start reading Hordern right off, because I'm going to follow his development more than any of the others. Hordern, Layman's Guide to Protestant Theology. The second book that I would like you to read is the Introductory Studies in Contemporary Theology, because that's really where we're going to be Monday. And then the third book I really gave you for your own benefit. You ought to read it because it comes in toward the end and puts things back together again. And so in some ways you have a course in your three books that will supplement this. And I am not going to follow it exactly, but I hope you will read it. In fact, I probably am going to flat give you an assignment that by Monday Hordern is read. And I'm going to ask. Knowing you, that's all it's going to take. And then we'll work this. I also will assign you a paper to read or to write during the 2 weeks. But I'm going to give myself a day or so to tune into you before I decide on what it's going to be on.